seated.
I don't know if I should apologize for that gospel hymn. It seemed like a good idea on Wednesday. And then sometimes by Sunday morning, as you know, I know it's kind of a tricky both tune and rhythm and unfamiliar. So anyway, welcome again to St. Andrew's. Wonderful lessons to talk about today. I'm going to sort of work backward, go from the gospel to what Paul says in Romans, and then finish with this passage from Exodus. And really, we probably should be listening to this gospel with last week's reading and this week's reading together. The separation of a week sort of takes away some of the force of that sudden reversal where Peter is saying, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," and all of it that surrounds giving the keys of the kingdom. And then instantly, Peter is cautioning Jesus and saying, "You must not go to Jerusalem where you will be killed." And in probably the most stinging rebuke of the New Testament, Jesus says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are thinking in a human way and not in God's way." And then really where I want to focus is what Jesus says quite regularly. If you want to save your life, you will lose it. If you lose your life for my sake, you will find it. And really to understand what that means in its depth and profundity, we would need to know really how it is that we are formed as human persons and how we represent ourselves to ourselves and what it is that we cling to and what we let go of. Starting point is, while we might hear, especially in the context of this story where Jesus is going to Jerusalem there to meet his physical death, the word in the Greek is not, it really doesn't have anything to do with physical life. That's not the life that is being considered at this point. If you would save your life, the Greek word there is psyche. If you would save your psyche, you will lose it. If you lose your psyche for my sake, you will find it. And that can be translated as perhaps soul. But it, in any case, it's not just biological life that we're talking about. And so what in what sense are we asked to lose our psyches? And, boy, talk about a developmental sketch. Often in baptism, an infant is brought, and almost invariably I point out that sort of tension between what historically has been the theology of the church, namely that this child is claimed by original sin and is in some way flawed or bad, and that that needs to be taken away. And I think that is a pernicious theology. But the reality is that even every infant that is born into human culture is going to begin a process of the formation of themselves. And they are going to start experiencing the world that responds to them by praising some things and forbidding or shaming them about others. And as they get more involved in culture, they are going to start hearing comparisons. Well, you're better than that person and not so good as that person. And that happens physically, and it happens intellectually, and it happens monetarily. All of this begins to create a story. This is good, this is bad, this is who I am. And in large measure, that story of the self that we tell ourselves is the self. Sometimes in psychological terms, it is called the false self. But it's the self that is ritually put to death in baptism. For an infant, we do it preemptively. We say, we as your community are going to see if we can stay around you and have your process of formation be guided by the truth of who you are, which is not contained in any story. And the words, they actually are with me fairly regularly. T.S. Eliot, in the Four Quartets, says, "There is a limited value in the knowledge derived from experience." A limited value in the knowledge derived from experience. The experience imposes a pattern, and the pattern falsifies. For the pattern is new in every moment, and every moment is a new and shocking valuation of all we have been. Now that, I mean, is in a sense living deeply in the present moment. And so the choice almost is, are you going to live in a story that is an accretion of the past, or are you going to live more directly in this encounter and relationship to the world that occurs in the present moment? And that forgetting of one's story, or that softening of one's story, not knowing who one is, we have reason to fear that, I think, because for everyone who undergoes a radical change of life, like St. Francis, who passed through a period where everyone thought he was crazy, but he turns out to be a rather radiant beacon of light and love, for every person who does that and sort of forgets who they are and inhabits a new and more vibrant self, there are probably 1,000 that buy Corvettes and have a midlife crisis and have their lives run off the rails in an attempt to throw off what they have come to believe is a restricting story in their lives. And so in our attempts to avoid catastrophic sort of disruption of our lives, we often miss what it might be like to live more deeply in the real present moment, not being obedient, which is to say listening and responsive, not being obedient to this story we have told ourselves all our lives. And of course we tell ourselves stories not just about who we are, but who others are. And those stories go into making a world that is divided. They are they, and we are us and them. I mean, it's that power of story needs to be softened, needs to be held much more lightly. So something like that is what Jesus is talking about. If you would save your psyche, if you would cling to the story that you tell yourself about yourself, you are, in a sense, imprisoning yourself in limitations. But if you would forget that story and live more deeply in the present moment, you will discover a life there that you could not imagine from your previous place. Paul. You have to love Paul, that seemingly is talking about Jesus in his teaching of love your enemies, but he manages to get in the little dig. If you love your enemies, you'll dump hot coals on their heads, you know. And that's Paul. And he's quoting Proverbs. So this teaching goes way back, and I actually think it has complete currency in our modern world. The way it works is this. It's kind of a psychological truth. I think it's pretty clear that we're not always completely conscious of what's going on inside ourselves. And often we are not quite aware of things that we might be feeling, for instance. And sometimes it's hard to believe why I would be angry with Anne, but I might be. And if I'm not aware of my anger at you, I will be doing things in relation to you that will be provoking you to be angry with me. I will be, in a sense, teaching you and inviting you and giving you bait that will entice you, in a sense, feel my feelings for me and live out my feelings for me. And then if you get angry with me, then I can say, oh man, you are, oof. How convenient. I mean, that's the way it works psychologically. But now, Anne, if you respond to my provocations with kindness, these feelings that I have not yet recognized have nowhere to go except to come back to me. Metaphorically, the hot coals are dumped on my head. You know, when things that we are trying to entice the world around us to live out for us, especially our negative things, which is where we get enemies and such, if those do not come back to us forcing this unconscious dance of hostility. If they don't come back to us, then we are left to wrestle with what our own feelings and our own responsibilities and our own place really is in this relationship. So Paul is on to something. It's wisdom, but he does. There's a little too much glee in Paul at the prospect of dumping hot coals on anybody's head. He just seems to be that kind of guy. So now we go to this great, great text from Exodus. Just one last word about the Paul. You know, it says, never avenge yourselves, leave room for the wrath of God. Except the Greek text doesn't say wrath of God. It just says wrath. Leave room for the wrath. I don't know what that means exactly, but I would prefer an ambiguity to a falsehood. It does not say the wrath to thing of God. It doesn't say it. So translators just add that, thinking, well, that's what it must mean. I'm not so sure. So now back to Exodus. We've already spoken about how we are not, as human beings, fully conscious. Very clear that we're not fully conscious. It's also very clear that this encounter that Moses had with a burning bush, with the encounter with the world, is a moment of greatly heightened consciousness. That, in a sense, Moses woke up there. And as Teilhard de Chardin said, nothing is profane for one who knows how to see. And if we were fully conscious, all of us, all the time, every bush would burn. The world would burn with the radiance of its creator. We see that only intermittently and sort of imperfectly. But so this is a great moment of awakening. And the divine presence that is revealed to Moses is, I think, the absolute best we have for God in God's own nature. It's not, I am good, I am powerful, I am just, I am anything, except I am who I am. Pure being, the pure source of being. The one source of all that exists. And that is, you know, the unpronounceable name of God, beyond which I think we have never yet been able to go. But there is contained in this story of the pure beingness of God, the thusness, that I hope has startled every one of us. Maybe we have not had encounters as vivid as a burning bush, but pay attention to the sort of ebb and flow of your own attentiveness and your own presence. And are there not times when the world, for no reason at all, becomes more vivid and we ourselves feel ourselves to be more present to that world? Well, imagine just that occurring with profound intensity, and you have something going on with Moses. And you hear this something about the nature of God who hears the cry of the Israelites. And the divine nature is revealed to be such that when human injustice exercises itself, when the powerful take from the weak, and when the strong oppress the weak, that is deeply out of accord with the nature of reality, with God. And that God's presence, in ways that are often quite mysterious to us, will work to redress that balance and restore a balance. And you hear that in this story of, I have heard the cry of my people and the Israelites, and I will deliver you. But the story is, as I think all our sacred stories are, for us at least, and for our response to them, incomplete. Because in this magnificent glory of the being of God, we also have huge elements of human incompleteness and confusion. For God sends Moses to deliver Israel, but it's not yet clear that the God of Moses is also the God of the Egyptians. And it is certainly not yet clear that the God God of Israel is also the God of the Jebusites and the Hittites and the Canaanites and all the peoples whom this presence declares to Moses, I will give you their lands. And so some people speak of these as texts in travail. They have partial truth, and the truth is profound and it is deep, and we can hold it for all our lives. And yet it's also situated in history. And people did not know when Moses had this encounter with the presence of God, did not know that that God and that presence was also to be revealed as the God of all peoples. And if Moses didn't quite know that, and the Israelites didn't quite know that, I would have to say that we also do not quite know that. We are on the way still to working out the implications of what it might really mean to understand that the one presence of God is the God of not just all peoples, but of all creation. And that God is not against anybody. God is for everyone to bring out all life in its fullness and depth and truth and authenticity. That's what we're called to. And we may have made some advances over the time of Moses. And yet, what a glorious vision to open our hearts to. That the one who says only of God's self, I am who I am, will be known and loved as the creator and sustaining presence of all peoples of the earth and of all creation. That's what lies ahead. Amen.